Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Hello and welcome to New Horror Express, your weekly podcast chatting to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer. I'm your host Scott Murphy, and on today's episode I'm chatting to writer-director Chad Farron about his most recent effort, The Deep Ones. Over the course of the interview, you will hear Chad talk about why he wanted to make a Lovecraftian film, not wanting to annoy Lovecraft fans, and why he took the somewhat unusual decision of having some of the characters reading out bits of Lovecraft within the film. I also talked to him about how they achieved the many tentacly effects on the film, how reanimator-composer Richard Band jumped aboard the project, and why he decided to edit the film under a pseudonym. Plus, we get his reaction to the positive response the film has received in its festival run to date. All of which and much, much more you can hear right now in our interview with Chad. Hi, Chad. Welcome to New Horror Express.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me.
So today we have you on the show to talk about your film H.P. Lovecraft's The Deep Ones. For the audience listening at home, can you give us a brief spoiler-free synopsis of H.P. Lovecraft's The Deep Ones?
Yeah, it's basically Rosemary's Baby meets Lovecraft. It's got a little bit of Shadow over Innsmouth, a little bit of Stepford Wives. I mean, there's a whole bunch of inspirations that I love that's freckled throughout there. And, you know, it's kind of a fun little romp with, you know, even a little bit of comedy in there to in the vein of Stuart Gordon or Brian Usna. It's one of those things where the inspiration, hopefully you see it more of as an homage than a ripoff. And so far, a lot of the audience has seen that, luckily, and not burned down my house in rage that I've trampled on the name of Lovecraft.
For sure. I definitely saw those influences when watching the film. I did a podcast where I talked to a few other people about Grimfest, and I saw it as a kind of, yeah, I thought it had, like, I said at the time that it felt like a mixture of Rosemary's Baby, Dead and Buried, Society, Humanoids from the Deep, and Reanimator.
Yes, all of those. I'm a big fan of Dead and Buried, and that's another thing that just had such a great atmosphere and things like that that you, whether you did it consciously or subconsciously, there's those things that you loved as a kid or discovered recently that really kind of just stick in your head, and they come out, and whether it be in the writing or the filming or whatever it might be. And when people pick that up, it's really just, you know, exciting for me when someone says, oh, well, you know, Dead and Buried, or, you know, Stuart Gordon, or any of those references, or, you know, anything Roger Corman. It's a great thing, and it makes me smile every time I read it, even if it's a bad review. When they mention those things, it's like, hey, at least I got a Roger Corman mention in there.
So were those kind of like, did those things kind of come out subconsciously of just these are the things that you're in that territory and these are the things that you love, or is it's kind of like I'm deliberately hitting these points?
No, it's definitely, I mean, the Rosemary's Baby aspect was definitely intentional. Everything else is, you know, and aside from the Chud aspect of the creature at the end, those things were, everything else kind of came naturally or
subliminally.
There you go, bingo. So those things kind of just came out, and you know, even when, you know, I was originally cutting it all together, it, you know, and I would kind of discover these things after, you know, being on set, and it's like, oh, that's from that and that, and it just kind of subconsciously just kind of came in there.
I think it's very much, you know, like the Dead and Buried thing is like, it's very much, I feel like the opening is like, I think that's where kind of got that.
Sure. So that's just such a great film. I mean, it really has an amazing atmosphere and an ending that just kicks you. So it's one of those things that I, you know, always try to do, at least an ending that, or an opening that hooks people and pulls them in, and an ending that leaves them, you know, whether they liked it or not, a little breathless. So
absolutely. Yeah, no, like you say, it's a great film. And an underrated film. I feel like not enough people have seen it, even horror fans.
Yeah, you know, it's an amazing film. You know, you can't go wrong with O'Bannon. So, I mean, anything he writes or has any involvement with is usually pretty top-notch.
So what initially inspired you to go ahead and make a Lovecraft film?
Well, it all happened with Gina, the lead who plays Alex. She had this beach house, and I met her for another project. I had this kind of a female death wish that I was script that I was kind of passing around. And Robert Miano introduced me to her, that she would be good for the lead in that. And she loved that script, and she went out trying to raise some money for it. She wasn't having any luck. And then she basically called me up one day and said, "Hey, what do you think about doing like a cheap slasher film? I've got this beach house for another few months, and we could just crank something out and see what happens." And I said, "Well, hey, send me the pictures of the house and I'll think on it." And she sent the pictures and the ocean and all these things. And I immediately thought of Lovecraft, and I've always wanted to do a cult film. So I told her on the phone, I'm like, "Look, I'm not interested in doing a slasher film at the moment, but I would love to do a Lovecraft cult film." And she's like, "Okay, well, write it up. You can use my house. You can use me. I'll throw in some money, and we'll see what happens." So in a couple of weeks, I whipped out a script, and she liked it. Robert Miano liked it. They both started raising a little more money, and it all came together really quickly. It was one of those things where it wrote itself, basically, and the people that it was sent to seemed to dig it. And, you know, before we knew it, we were shooting. It was one of those things, another film that was basically, you know, 100 pages long, and we had to shoot it in like 10, 12 days, and fast and furious. And the nice thing was that, knowing going in, some of the characters I had in mind, or the actors I had in mind for the characters, the location, it made it a lot easier kind of knowing your limitations of whether it be the location or the actors playing each role. And it really came together really fast, and it was a blast to shoot.
Yeah, so it sounds like it was a really, really quick turnaround. I mean, often I talk to a lot of different indie filmmakers, and often the journey from script to going into shooting is quite a difficult one, but it seems like it was pretty snappy when it came to this one.
Fastest on every aspect. It was basically written in December, shot mid-January, finished post in July, out to festivals. Let's see, the first festival that looked at it was Fantasia, and then it got into Grimfest, and all these other festivals started falling in line, and Sitges and all these things. And then basically offers from distributors were almost immediate. Just on the fact of, I don't know if it's the H.P. Lovecraft element with Lovecraft Country and, you know, Color Out of Space doing really well, but there was a huge amount of interest from distributors almost immediately, just from, you know, they said, "I saw it on IMDb, it's in post-production, can we look at a screener, when can we see it?" And, you know, now I'm in talks with a couple distributors ready to, you know, sign a deal, and we're just trying to figure out the dates that work to put it out. And, you know, one wants to put it out in 2022, another one in early 2021. So it's just kind of trying to figure out the best deal for it. But for me, it's been the fastest, you know, from script to actually potential of selling it and getting it out there for the public to see that I've ever had.
Were you at all concerned about that? I mean, you mentioned like Lovecraft Country and Color of Space, and there's also been other movies in recent years that have kind of drawn from Lovecraft, things like The Void and Mandy, things sure. like that. Were you at all concerned that you would be seen as bandwagon jumping or something like that?
No, I think, you know, my biggest concern was the that Lovecraft fans, you know, of his writing would say, "Oh my God, they're, you know, they're doing a disservice to his writings. They're, you know, not being true to it." And then, which could be the farthest from the opposite, is that because I'm a huge Lovecraft fan, and then the opportunity to actually embrace his work and try to make something, you know, inspired by it was, you know, a dream come true. But at the same time, you're worried that people are going to say, "Hey, this has nothing to do with Lovecraft, that he would be turning in his grave," or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you got to take it with anything, that at least I think a lot of people can see that the elements that are taken are weaved in, you know, in a sense that it's you know, in homage to his work or inspired by greatly, and not just, you know, treading on his stuff or using his name to try to sell the damn thing, which is farthest from what could be, because, you know, again, I'm a huge fan of his writing, and I hope it's seen that way and not something that would be, like you said, jumping on the bandwagon.
Is it actually, there's, you know, something you don't often see that seems to be, you know, people like reading bits of Lovecraft, kind of, you know, like kind of Lovecraftian things in the movie.
Yeah, no, it's one of those things when, you know, I was rereading a lot of his works, and I would just get so amazed by, you know, this is written, you know, over 100 years ago, and it's just so relevant and so, you know, out of this world in a sense. And when you have, you know, some actors reading his actual writing in their character, it's just like, on the set, I was blown away, because when you hear it, you know, read by a good actor, it just really kind of floors you. So it was one of those things where, for me, it got me excited. So it's one of those things where, as a writer, director, and, you know, editor eventually, you have to go with things that excite you. It's like, I got a lot of flack for the nudity, and people would say, oh, you can't have that in this day and age and whatnot. And I'm like, well, you know what? I like it. I like seeing a beautiful woman running naked. It's an amazing thing. So I want to put it in the movie, and I'm going to put it in the movie. And if they don't like it, I don't give a shit. So you have to take a stand on some of those things where, you know, people would take a look at the rough cut or whatever, and they'd say, yeah, you should really remove that. And sometimes I listen to things, and it's, you know, okay, I'll bend on that and take it out, or change, you know, a character doing that instead of that. But there's some things that I have to stick to, because that's the way I want it. And what gets me excited about going to the movies, you know, you don't see things like that often anymore. And I'm a huge fan of the 60s, 70s, and 80s cinema. So it's one of those things of trying to get that feeling back that I had as a kid, when you'd sit in the theater and a beautiful body would be rushing in front of you on the scene, or whatever it might be. And, you know, just kind of bring that back in a sense.
It does in the movie have a kind of, definitely a kind of 80s throwback feel. And that seems to be very deliberate.
Yes, definitely.
So I was going to ask as well, you know, obviously talking about things like Lovecraft Country and Color Out of Space, and there's obviously famously problematic elements of Lovecraft's writing. And while those movies kind of, while those things kind of more deliberately tackle that, your film kind of, there's like a kind of, I feel like there's a kind of sly satire there about the kind of homogeny and whiteness of this community. It's not in your face, but I do feel like you're still playing with those elements.
Sure. Well, you know, it's one of those things where I've always kind of been a colorblind casting sort of aspect, where if, you know, a Black actor or an Asian actor or whoever it might be comes in and they're great in the role or reading, or they're up for it, I cast them. If, you know, it was one of those things of the luck of the draw that everyone happened to be white or fit that Lovecraftian idea of the perfect cult, which would be, you know, this Aryan kind of blend, which I think would stay true to his, you know, I don't want to get into his racial things, because I think that's a little unfair to, you know, try to take away from someone's talent just on their political beliefs or their racial, whatever that might be. I try not to get into those things too much. And, you know, it's just it's kind of the luck of the draw. If an actor had came in that was, you know, amazing for the Petri character and he happened to be Black, then it would have, you know, been a different thing and a different casting choice. But nothing was really intentional of saying, hey, everyone's got to be this white bread kind of Aryan looking thing for the cult members. It was just kind of happened.
And in terms of the cast, you know, how it seems like the cast came together quite quickly. Did you kind of have most of those people in mind for those roles? I know you've worked with several of the cast members before. You worked with Robert Mayano and Kelly Maroney on Exorcism at 60,000 Feet. You've Sylvia Sprosse and Timothy Muscatel has been in several of your films. Were most of the people kind of you had in mind while writing the script?
Yeah, they were all pretty much in mind. I mean, because, you know, if I work with someone and they're good, whether it be a performance or personality wise or whatever, I'd usually like to work with them again, because they can come up with stuff that's interesting, like with improvisation and just, you know, a good energy on the set. And Tim and Kelly and Robert Miano. I mean, all these people were just are just amazing to work with. And there was Bai Ling was actually originally going to be Timothy Muscatel's character, Dr. Rayburn, originally, and we were all kind of set up and everything was falling into place. And then her agent kind of got involved and it kind of went sideways. But you know, he kind of came in because I worked with him before and I threw it past him like, hey, would you be interested in, you know, playing a woman? And he jumped at it and he was great. And it added a whole new a level to it that, you know, some people take as the old transgender thing and all that kind of aspect, which really wasn't intentional at first. It was originally written for Bai Ling, but then it happened the way it happened. And Tim, you know, stepped in and was great. And had a lot of fun with it.
Actually, yeah, I that's interesting because, like, yeah, I kind of took that from the character, and I was kind of pleasantly surprised it wasn't it. What there, it was like a kind of trans character that was just kind of it was there, and there was no kind of joke made around that or anything like that. It was just like, yeah, this is a character. This is who it is.
Well, it came up to, you know, one of those ideas as you can, you know, he took the character of, you know, a combination between B. Arthur and, you know, Hillary Clinton or whatever his inspirations were, John Cleese, and he kind of just worked them in to this thing. And the idea was kind of, you know, the old one that inhabited his human form was, you know, female. And it, you know, it just kind of, there are numerous ways to look at it that, especially from his angle as an actor to playing it, that we kind of talked about and said, you know, hey, if it's an alien inside your body and the alien's female and you're a male, and how would that, you know, come out? The being inside of you wanting to dress female or talk female or look female would take over the male aspect of it. So that's kind of how we tackle it. But not in a, you know, a modern term of what transgender is or any of that stuff, because, you know, when I was, none of that stuff existed. When we were kids, it was just kind of like a woman dressed as a man. But when you look at it now through, you know, the perspective of today's eyes, and then also with the element of this alien entity and being female and kind of work that in, it kind of happened in a very interesting way. And I think, you know, something that can be at least talked about, though, at least that's an interesting way to look at it instead of just a man dressed in drag trying to portray this character.
Yeah. And I think it actually works well. I think the character is one of the most fun characters in the movie. So how was the shoot for the film? It seems like overall, not just the getting from script to the shoot, it seems like the whole production went quite well. Was there any particular on-set disasters or any major complications, or was it really quite smooth from beginning to end?
No, it was really, you know, quite smooth. I mean, the only hiccup for me is it was about 70 miles one way from my house to the location. So, you know, each day would be about 140 miles to drive. And some people were allowed to stay at the location and sleep there, but as the director, I kind of like to keep a distance between myself and the actors, just so there's just not that familiarity, you know, to just kind of keep that, hey, here's our boss. We don't want to see him, you know, farting and, you know, making jokes after, just to keep the professional level of it. So I chose to drive home every day. So after, you know, a few days of doing that, it got a little exhaustive. You know, you'd shoot 14 hours in a day and you have to drive home 70 miles. And a couple times I fell asleep at the wheel and almost crashed the car. But aside from that, it was, you know, amazingly smooth. Everyone, you know, usually banged it out in a couple takes, and there were no deaths, no injuries. So it was pretty good.
Excellent. I love the fact that it's like, yeah, apart from my near death or possible near death, that, you know, everything was smooth sailing.
But you got to take, you know, it's one of those things where you kind of realize just how fragile things are when you almost crash and die. It's like, you know, that could have gone so much worse. So the fact that here the film is done, it's getting some good reviews, it's getting to festivals, there's distribution offers. And you could have died. So it's, you know, look at the bright side of everything, that it came out the way it did. And in hindsight, it's like, oh, maybe I should have, you know, slept in my car or taken a break and caught up with the Z's before I, you know, hit the wheel.
Yeah, maybe. But thankfully, it all worked out well in the end.
Right. Old Lovecraft is, keeping an eye on it.
Yeah, so going back to Lovecraft, obviously, it's all about the kind of atmosphere, and the kind of creatures are often vaguely described in Lovecraft's writing. So you mentioned Chuds. As a kind of inspiration, was there any other inspirations for the kind of creatures in the movie?
Well, it was basically Chud and an actual Cthulhu drawing that Lovecraft himself had drawn. So I kind of, sent that over to Jim Olja, who did the effects, and we kind of went back and forth, and then, on the drawings for the creature, and then, he nailed it and said, here, this is what it's going to be. Here's a rough sketch. I'm like, that looks pretty good. And then when I saw it for the first time on the day of shooting, I was like, holy crap. The eyes were glowing and it was all, slimed up. It looked great. I'm like, I can't wait for it to get in bed with the actresses. It was, but it's one of those things where, especially on a low budget, you expect one thing and then you have to be kind of set. I do anyway, you're given a certain amount of time and a certain amount of budget to get stuff done. And if your expectations are out of, are on a bigger scale, you're going to be let down. So I kind of try to keep what could be and what might be, whether it be in the shooting or the effects or whatever, to a minimum. And if it's like, if it doesn't work, you can quickly go and say, here, let's try it from this angle so the effects can pass, or let's, take that out because we don't have the time to get, these other pages done. So it's just kind of thinking on your feet and being prepared for the worst. And sometimes you're surprised by what they come up with. Like when he finished Sylvia's glowing eyes that were basically inspired by Horror Express, which is another favorite of mine. I was blown away when I saw him. And it was just one of those things where the practical effects for me are always much better than CGI. So kind of sticking with that on set feel of how the effects look. And when you're looking through the camera and you're seeing those eyes light up and you're like, okay, this is pretty awesome. And it's all in camera and it's there. And it's, it's a lot of fun. And I think it also helps performances because the actor is able to see, this monster coming at her or these eyes glowing or whatever it might be on set. And it helps with their performances.
Yeah. The glowing eyes effect. That's pretty good. Yeah. Of course, the Horror Express. That's a entertaining film, and a film I really should have remembered when I named this podcast.
Exactly.
Because if you Google New Horror Express, you're getting a lot of Horror Express stuff first. But anyway, that's by the by. I was wondering, just talking about kind of creature design, there's a fish man in the movie that looks really similar to the fishmen in a British film called The Barge People. Have you ever seen The Barge People?
I've seen the trailer for it, and when I saw that, I was like, wow, that's the same the same mask that he had on the guy in our thing, which was originally, that's again where budget comes into play. Uh-huh. It was like, Jim could only be on set for effects for 4 days. So every effect scene that was, kind of a big thing, like the tentacles or whatever it would be coming out of Sylvia's crotch, those things were kind of put on each day. So that was the first day of filming, the creature rape stuff, that was the last day. So everything was kind of sprinkled out, so effects would be put on the thing. And for the creature on the boat, we had Jim for that day, and I said, hey, we've got this creature that needs to be kind of reached the end of the Innsmouth look, and he's ready to basically be put back into the ocean. And he's like, well, I've got this mask that might work, and it'd be cheaper than me doing a whole new appliance and whatnot. And and he pulled out this mask, and I'm like, oh, that's great, that looks very good. Threw the mask on him, did the scene, and it worked. And then when I was cutting the film, I saw the trailer for The Barge People, and I'm like, man, it's the same damn mask. I guess it was a popular mask.
It must be. Because I interviewed Charlie Steed, who directed the Barge People. So I saw that movie a while back, and so when I saw your film, I was like, that's like the same creature, the same. So right. I was like, ah, oh, interesting.
But no, it wasn't. I guess it must be a somewhat a well-known mask in some respects. I don't know. But it was one of those things when I saw it, I was like, oh my God. So there it is. It made a turn. Return.
So I was talking about the effects. Which of the effects was most complicated to shoot, and which was the most fun to shoot?
I guess the most fun to shoot was the tentacle coming out of Sylvie and going into Johan's mouth was probably the most fun, because not only was the effect neat, this tentacle coming out of a girl's crotch and going into this guy's mouth and him deep throating it, but the fact that the actors involved really kind of just had fun with it, and they weren't can we get this over with, I'll give you one more take, it's rubbing against my crotch or it's going down my throat, I'm gagging. They were all just really kind of had fun with it, and that kind of set the tone for the rest of the shoot, where no one really complained about anything and they all kind of took it as it is. Whereas, I can't imagine, sucking down that tentacle for 20 takes is that fun. But, Johan was great about it and didn't complain and crack jokes. And that kind of set the mood for the rest of the shoot. And everyone kind of took, the lumps as they come, and nobody complained. Everyone just seemed to have fun. And, I guess the toughest part was the creature coming out of the ocean and all that kind of stuff, because originally that was envisioned happening all on the beach and, torches all around and him coming out of the water and getting right on top of the girl and all that kind of stuff. But when, having never shot at a beach before, when we got there and night started coming and everyone's like, well, the tide's going to be coming up pretty soon and you won't have any beach left. And I'm like, what does that mean? And they're like, well, go down there and look. And before, there was, a couple hundred feet of beach, and now there was about 10 feet as the water kept getting higher and higher and higher. And I'm like, oh God. So there goes that envisioning of how it came. So it had to kind of change of this creature coming out of the ocean, coming up these steps to the backyard of this house, which luckily we had that option, because otherwise, it was like we'd have to shoot everybody underwater getting raped by this creature. So it was just one of those things of, again, thinking on the fly and kind of thinking out a different way of shooting it last minute. And, and again, it was only, that night to finish out all the creature stuff, because we only had, that time frame to shoot it in. So it was just kind of, it makes it much harder when you're doing an effects thing and you've only got a few hours to get it right and get it done, when you've got a whole bunch of extras and, it's getting late and people are, starting to get a little tired of the nonstop chanting and all that kind of stuff. So the most fun was the opening shot around the boat with the tentacles, and the worst was probably the creature and the suit and all that stuff.
So it sounds like there was quite a lot of camaraderie on set. There was quite a fun shoot overall.
Yeah, no, it was a blast. I mean, it was really one of those things where everyone seemed to like each other, and they were doing, whether, for me, it's always trying to keep things moving. Because it's usually on bigger sets that I've been on, they only have to do like 5 pages a day, and everyone's kind of sitting around and, waiting for the next shot. They can take, an extra couple hours to light a scene or whatever it is. But for me, it's all about time is money. And, we've only got, one day to get 10, 12 pages done. So to get them done right and to get more camera angles, speed is, the major factor. So I try to rehearse it, get a good feel for it, get the camera up, and then get the actors to get one take their way, one take my way, improvise some stuff, get some stuff more, as much footage as possible for the editing room, and just kind of figure it out from there. Because a lot of times when you've got the luxury of time and to, spend it, days on a scene, like ideally it would have been great to spend a whole day or two on, each scene, especially effects stuff. But when you've only got a matter of hours, you really have to make it count. And, luckily I've had that kind of experience with Trauma and some other things where, you have to get it done and get it done fast, because there's no coming back to do it, because there's no money to do that. So luckily I've had most things never having to come back for reshoots, never missing anything, because cutting most of my films as well, I have everything with an editor's eye. So I'm like, oh, we need a close-up of the lighter falling, or we need this, 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 and can grab it all within that day. And, another interesting thing, we didn't have an AD, on the set. So it was kind of this whole thing of the great thing with a small cast and crew is everyone's kind of, you know, working for the same thing and to get as best as you can and not, you know, sitting around and, hey, where'd, you know, Johan go? Where is he? He's in his trailer. Well, there is no trailer. He's right there. Grab him. Let's go and get it done. So the camaraderie, I think, really helped in everyone's energy and knowing that, hey, we've got a limited amount of time to do this and let's give it our best and, you know, get it in and out. And that's really how it went.
Yeah, I can often feel that, you know, when you're watching a film, you can feel when actors are maybe like doing a film for a paycheck or whatever, or just phoning it in, whereas all the performances seem quite committed in this movie. You know, everybody seems to be, there seems to be fun being had on screen in these roles.
Sure. I think that's the great thing about working with actors that you've worked with before, and they kind of have your back in a sense. And I think if you were working with someone new like Gina and Johan, who I had never worked with before, I think they can kind of pick that up where they're like, okay, he's got, you know, all these people behind him. We can't really go too much or cause too much trouble because then everyone on set would hate us. Whereas if you're working on something where, you know, Spielberg had kind of the same problem when he was doing, you know, I think a Night Gallery episode, one of his earlier things, and all the crew was these older guys, and here comes this young 20-something kid, and he's, you know, got all these great ideas and these big things that are against the grain of what a studio shoot normally is, so they all kind of hated him. And I think for me, it's like you've got this backup of, you know, actors I've worked with, crew I've worked with, and they all kind of know my shorthand of working, and they kind of fall in line with that and embrace it and have fun with it. And that, I think, was a major factor of how these other actors kind of that I hadn't worked with before kind of fell in to that mode of working, where normally they probably don't have the luxury of being able to improvise or, you know, come in, because I try to make it as welcoming a set as possible and artistically open as possible, where it's not my way or the highway. It's like I'm open to hear your ideas and see what you come up with, and nine times out of ten it's probably better than the idea. Let's try both ways and see what works best. And I think you know, the cast and the crew respect that and they enjoy it, and it seems to get things done the quickest. And also the like, you know, Tim's character will come up with something funny, like slurping the coffee, and everyone has a laugh, and it brings a sort of levity to, you know, the whole thing, and it makes everyone seem to be like, hey, this is a big party. Let's we hope it never ends. And that kind of went, you know, from day one to day 12 or whatever it was.
And talking about people you've worked with before, you've also worked with the composer Richard Band before. Did you get him on board to do the score because of his previous record in Lovecraftian films?
Yeah, of course. And the fact that, you know, I fought to get him on the Exorcism film. And then when I met him, he was great. And then working with him on the score for that was great. And, you know, he's just not only, you know, amazingly talented. And every time you see a movie, whether it be, you know, Reanimated or From Beyond, you just know it. There's a Richard Band score. And, you know, it's just got this great element to his work. And when we finished the Exorcism movie and I tossed the idea out to him that I was doing this Lovecraft film, if he would be interested in doing it, and, you know, knowing that I don't have the same budget we did on the Exorcism movie, and I, you know, he said, sure, send me the script, I'd love to take a look at it when you're done. And I sent him the script, he liked the script, he wanted to come out to the set when we were shooting, and, you know, he was really just on board from, you know, the moment that I mentioned it. And you know, when we worked out when I sent him the rough cut, he liked it. He gave me notes on some scenes and I took them because, you know, he's a Lovecraft expert. So, you know, it was really one of those things of a great collaboration from the previous film to this film and hopefully the next one.
And it really adds to that kind of 80s vibe that, you know, the film kind of inhabits. The score. And I did also enjoy his score to the Exorcism film, which I watched earlier today, which seemed to be like a kind of horror spin on the Airplane score.
Exactly.
that was quite entertaining.
Oh, he's great. And he's one of the, you know, he's one of those composers that's so underappreciated that it's amazing, because especially doing the Lovecraft film, I'm like, who else would I get? You know, and I told him who, You know, and he said that he had done maybe 6 or 7 Lovecraft films all in all. So,
yeah, of course.
It's, you know, it's one of those things where, and, you know, even if he hadn't, I just love his scores. And there's just something about it, you know, even when we were going through the rough cut and I gave some suggestions like, well, I'd love to have a theremin in there somewhere. And, you know, he incorporated that. So, you know, some composers I've worked with are a little harder to, you know, they'll say, here it is. This is it. But Richard, you know, not only is he a pro and he's done countless movies, he's open to input and just, you know, a joy to work with. And it's one of those things when 9 times out of 10, he'll, you know, score a scene and send it over for me to listen to. And I hear it, I'm like, no notes, that was perfect. So, which is a rare thing, because most of the time you'll get, you know, a composer will do something for a scene and they'll send it over and you're like, oh, it's great, but there it needs this and that, this. So for me, it's just like, you know, a kid on Christmas when Richard sends, here's the score, and you listen to it and you're just blown away and you don't have to have any notes. It's just, it's done.
So it sounds like it was a very collaborative experience.
Oh, it was great. And it's, you know, it's one of those things when I was talking to him the other day, I'm like, hey, would you be up for a sequel? Because if this distribution deal goes through, I almost have to do a sequel almost immediately. So,
do you have ideas for a sequel? Obviously, the kind of endings.
Yeah, no, I had an idea. You know, it's one of those things when I'm cutting a film, I'm just so excited. It's coming together and it's done and I really like it. And it's not until, you know, notes come in that you're kind of, you know, oh, I guess I you know, you just your level of excitement when something is done, good or bad or indifferent. It's just an excitement. And with this one, I had a great excitement. And you know, most people really liked it, and you know, the reviews so far have been pretty good. So it's one of those things where I can definitely improve upon some of those things. But for me, it was, you know, one of the few films that, especially with the whole Lovecraft angle, there are many directions to go with, you know, following other Lovecraft stories or pulling in something together. But you know, this idea for me for the sequel was basically, you know, Robert Miano's character is floating out in the ocean, his body, you know, dumped in the ocean because he's presumed dead, and then, you know, he's not dead. And the idea was, you know, a ship picks him up. They, you know, they're like, he's alive, he's still alive. But the old one, the alien, has left his body. So he has all the memories of what has happened for the past 120 years since his, you know, body was taken over. So it's a bit of this immortality mixed with, you know, the things that this cult had done, and then kind of following his character more into the mythos of Lovecraft and all that kind of stuff while being kind of pursued by the cult in it. So that was one idea that was swimming around. And if, you know, it's when you, there's certain things that you have, it's like, okay, there's the opening, and you kind of go from there and kind of let the script and the film find its way. And so, you know, it's off to a start. And again, the things that help is if a distribution deal comes through, and these, it kind of just helps spur the creative idea that, okay, there is an interest in this. A distributor obviously wants to pay something for it, so there's a value to that. So you can kind of work that out to the budget of the next one, and kind of just, you know, it lays the groundwork. So the idea is there, and if everything falls into place, it'll happen.
You were talking of the mythos there. For this film, were there particular Lovecraft stories that you were drawing from?
Yeah, it was basically Call of Cthulhu, Shadow over Innsmouth, Dagon, and a little bit of Dunwich Horror were the main.
And obviously Lovecraft's known for that kind of oppressive atmosphere. There's interesting things that you do in the film to kind of create a kind of jarring, unsettling atmosphere. And I was wondering, like, there's a lot of like really tight close-ups in the film. Is that something you kind of deliberately did to kind of create a kind of oppressiveness?
Yeah, no, definitely. It was one of those things where the DP Jeff Billings and I you know, we were studying Rosemary's Baby and read this article where I guess it was a cinematography magazine had interviewed the DP of Rosemary's Baby not that long ago. And the idea was that they used, I think it was an 18 and, is it a 50? An 18 and a 15, 50 millimeter lens throughout basically the entire film to kind of give it this symmetry and kind of this feel. And we're like, hey, well, let's try that. So we basically use the same lens size that they shot Rosemary's Baby with on this to a degree. And it was just kind of trying to stick to that kind of close, kind of just claustrophobic in a sense feel. And if it worked, it worked. If it didn't, it didn't. The idea was, it's like, hey, we're using the same lenses that shot Rosemary's Baby to get the same kind of feel as Rose. It was worth a shot.
I was also wanting to ask about one of the interesting things that me and myself and a couple of co-hosts that I had when we were talking about Grimfest and talking about your film is we all kind of noted that there was this kind of odd, kind of almost daytime soap opera vibe to the film. And I didn't know if that was deliberate. I don't know if it's because of the setting and the location or the lighting. It's just a kind of nightmarish spin on a kind of daytime soap opera.
Well, I'm a huge fan of Dark Shadow. Okay. And, you know, that was another thing that, you know, the DP knew that. There were, you know, numerous inspirations like Dead and Buried and, you know, those things. But Dark Shadows is just such an amazing show for me, especially if you consider it's also a soap opera. Mm-hmm. And it's shot on a limited budget, and it just has such great writing and a great kind of feel to it, because you're watching, 1968 videotape, and it holds up in a sense. There's something about it that is not as jarring as, say, when The Twilight Zone switched a season or a few episodes on videotape and it was like, ugh, what is this? With Dark Shadows, it kind of fit the whole thing, especially, you know, the early black and white episodes that were on tape that just kind of fit not only the writing and the feel of it and the sets and all these things, but it just kind of made it this almost, it's hard to figure out, it didn't detract from it. You know, whereas a lot of things videotape will detract from, you know, the actual, you know, story, whether it be, you know, Doctor Who was always great when they would go out on location and it was on film, and then they're back to tape on, you know, the sets. So it's one of those things where I guess maybe it's another subliminal thing. I don't know, but it I'm kind of glad it does have that soap opera feel.
You mentioned as well that you kind of look at things with an editor's eye, and I noticed you've edited a number of your films. You edited the Exorcism film, for example, but you didn't edit this. Was there any particular reason for that?
Well, I don't like to really give it away, but I guess, you know, I'm on the wrong end of 50, so what's it hurt? My pseudonym is Jihad Farif. So,
oh, okay, sorry.
I've edited all my films and some other ones as well. But it's one of those things where I always hate it when you a director did this. It's like, okay, did craft service too? Great. It was always one of those things to kind of just make it seem like, okay, there's a little more. There was some money spent for an editor, or when in fact there wasn't, and it was me cutting it. So,
okay. Oh, that's interesting. That's very interesting. What I was wondering then, why on the Exorcism film did you use your actual name as the film editor, and this one you used the pseudonym? Is it because you did more things on this one?
Yeah, and it was one of those things where he kept, you know, praising the, you know, Robert Ryan, the writer and producer on Exorcism, really kept praising my editing, and I'm like, oh, man. Maybe I'll give myself the credit on this one. And where, you know, you're never, it's kind of an insecurity, I guess, where I never intended to be an editor. Well, I never intended to be a writer either, but it's one of those things that just kind of happened out of, invention in a sense, where you had to come up with those things, whether if you couldn't afford them or you couldn't find someone whose writing or editing were up to your standards, so to speak. And, it just kind of happened that way. And then before you know it, it's like, you know, people are saying, hey, that was a great edit for that or whatever. I'm like, oh, okay. I guess I'm an editor now. So, or a writer or whatever it might be, where I don't really take criticism that well, because I've always been, you know, kind of one of those people who never got it as a kid, so you're always kind of searching for it. And then even when you do get praise in whatever way, it's hollow in a sense because you're not used to it. So it's always kind of thing, you know. But at the same time, you know, one of the producers was saying, oh, maybe you should recut this because, you know, I don't really like that scene. And I'm like, well, fuck you. Sit just liked it. And Variety gave it a great review. So fuck you. So there's times where, you know, I'm fine taking criticism, but there's other times where it's like, it's too, you know, notes at this stage of the game of changing things are done. Because for me, when I finish a film and it's done and it's out there at festivals, I would rarely ever go back and recut things or change things, you know, based on, a producer wanting this or because of whatever bad review. It's you know, it's done, it's over, move on to the next.
You so know. Just always moving forward. You're not going to do a Ridley Scott or a Coppola or anything like that. Several different cuts.
But never say never, you know, you never know, you know, 50 years from now, you might be like, oh man, if I could change, and if someone's willing to pay it or do it, I mean, you know, why not? But at this stage, I kind of like to, you know, when once I finish something, it's done. Unless there's some kind of glaring error or something that needs to be, you know, rectified. But, you know, usually you lose that kind of energy. That the same thing when I was saying a distributor interested in a sequel or something like that, it gives you a certain energy and it helps kind of spur the creative juices in a sense that someone is interested and someone is, you know, willing to pay something or some. There's a light at the end of the tunnel, which I think in a sense made The Deep Ones so easy to write and get it done is because there was, you know, actors interested in putting in money. There was a location ready there. There was all these things. There was a light at the end of the tunnel, not just, hey, go whip up this script and let's just go do it. There was, you know, I knew the location, I knew the time frame and the budget and the things that had to be done and what could be achieved for that budget, and it just kind of made things easier to fit the pegs into the holes because you knew your limitations ahead of the time, instead of just saying, hey, I wrote this big script, it's got a car chase, it's got, you know, monsters, it's got this, and let's go try to raise the money. Whereas this kind of had the money or the idea of how much the money was, and you knew how much you had to play with and the time frame and the locations, and you kind of just worked the script around those things, and it kind of made it fit better and made something, you know, that much, much cheaper than what people think and, you know, look bigger than it really is, because you knew the limitations going in ahead of time and you kind of worked the script to those limitations.
I was wanting to talk a little bit more about the editing as well. It seems like that would be quite a difficult skill to create enough distance from the work to be like, yeah, this doesn't work. Yeah, that works. Yeah, this doesn't work. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, well, that's, you know, the perfect thing of originally in the script and in the edit, the opening scene is, you know, Sylvia running on the beach being chased by this flashlight and this unseen stalker. And then she's found help and she's brought up the stairs. And basically she sees the cult there and she's knocked unconscious. She's dragged in front, held down. The creature comes up. It rapes her. They're chanting. All that was in the opening, you know, 15, 20 minutes. So that's how it was written and shot. And then in the editing room, it was one of those things where it was like, oh my God, this is too much to give the audience. And it's too much for me, because it made me kind of sick seeing this much at the head of a film. And then you're supposed to kind of fall into this mystery and kind of be pulled along. So it just gave too much away and it was too traumatic in a sense for the audience. So, you know, I made the decision, you know, almost immediately to cut it out and kind of sprinkle it, you know, in the letter scene and, you know, on the boat scene and kind of move things around and just kind of having to let go of something that not only took a lot of, you know, time and energy to film that, and you were basically just truncating it. It's just knowing, you know, so many things that it's like when you shoot something, it's like, oh, that's a great shot. That's a, you know, a Orson Welles, Citizen Kane shot right there. It's amazing. It's beautiful and you love it. But if it slows down the story and it doesn't, you know, propel things, nobody gives a shit really in the end. So for me, it's kind of knowing when to cut something, and if it's not really propelling the story or whatever, I'm very cutthroat in that sense, where I don't really keep anything unless it's hard to say, but I'm very diplomatic in the sense that I'll listen to input on things and be able to cut it without saying, hey, I've got to keep that 100% or let it go. It's just kind of one of those things. What helps the flow of the film and make it work for, even if an audience hates it, they can say, well, I sat through the whole thing, which I think is more, you know, a compliment than anything else, because there's so many films today that I watch that are just unwatchable. You watch 10 minutes or 5 minutes or 3 minutes, and you're like, ugh, and you tune out. But if someone, you know, I read numerous reviews on whether it's IMDb or Letterboxd.com or whatever it is, where people will shit all over it and they'll give it a half star, but they still watched to the end, which that in itself, I think, is a feat these days. So, you know, and it's an attest to the editing and being knowing, for me, what works and what doesn't work. And, you know, by and by, most things, you know, tend to work for the best, but you have to know what does and what doesn't.
Talking of audience reactions, how pleased were you with the reaction it got at Grimfest? Because, like, obviously I watched it on the Grimfest digital edition, and I kept an eye and did an episode on Grimfest. I kept an eye on all the movies and the reactions all the movies got on social media, and your films seemed to get generally a positive reaction. Some people hated it, but like generally there was like quite a lot of people who really liked it.
Yeah, no, I was really surprised, because you know, most reviews for all of my other films are either love it or hate it, and this kind of had there were plenty of hate it's and a few love it's, but there were a lot of middle of the road, where it's like, you know, they'll give it a 5 out of 10, or you know, it was, which is kind of interesting to me, and maybe that's why it's got more of a distribution interest, is because it's not, you know, buckling the thing, you know, it doesn't have a full-on, you know, creature penis scene of, you know, raping this woman. It's, you know, there's a subtlety, and it's not trying to break the mold of, and to me, and that was kind of the sense of, you're trying to make something as commercial as possible, because you want it to be seen by as many people as possible. And if you were to go, you know, as crazy as I did in Someone's Knocking, or you know, some of the other films that had elements that were just too extreme for a general audience, you know, because I'm trying to broaden. Each film is different, of course, but you reach a point where you're like, I'd like to make something that's a little more, you know, obtainable, especially when I'm working with other investors' money and all those kind of things, because I want them to get paid back. It'd be nice if they even make a profit and they, you know, want to work with me again. So that is in the back of my mind. And when you read an audience reaction where it's kind of like, okay, so it's not too extreme, it's kind of the middle of the road, and I think it has enough surprises where you're like, ooh, you know, or things like that. To me, that's a success. And especially for this one, where it's, you know, everyone hates it and they're giving it a 1 star. Those that may not be that fond of it at least see a value to it, where it's entertaining, they give it a 4 or a 5 or whatever it is. So, you know, that's a success.
And I think it does have a kind of mixture of, like, it does feel very familiar in that kind of Stuart Gordon kind of Lovecraftian 80s feel, but it does have its own identity as well.
Oh, that's mission accomplished.
So you've been in the film game for quite a long time. I did want to ask you about, like, obviously one of your earliest credits, you were a production assistant on Halloween 6, and I right. just wondered, what was that like? Because obviously that's a famously troubled production. There's the 2 different cuts that came out, you know, a lot of arguments back and forth. Yeah, what was your experience there?
Well, the interesting thing is, you know, I got my first taste of the film business was this babysitter I had as a kid. You know, my family had kept in touch with her family, and she married this producer. Her name is Lori Leahy, and she married Mike Leahy. And he was running this production company called Neo Motion Pictures. And my mother had, you know, knowing that I wanted to be a director and into film my entire life and whatever, she called Lori's parents, and then they put her in touch with Lori and said, hey, can you give my son a job out in Hollywood? And, you know, they said, yeah, sure. Whenever he wants to come out here, he can come out here. So at one point, you know, I got my car, drove out here, and, you know, started working for Neo motion pictures as a production assistant on a few different films, for, you know, post-production on The Prophecy and Back to Back and a couple other things. And then they were doing reshoots for Hellraiser and the Halloween basically at the same time. So I was basically on doing set of reshoots, pickup shots for those two films kind of at the same time. And, you know, the only thing I remember from the Halloween aspect was working a couple days on a little stage with Joe Chappelle, and Tunnicliffe was doing the makeup, and it was, you know, just little insert shots for whatever they needed for pickup stuff on that. And for the Hellraiser one, I got to meet Doug Bradley and, you know, pick him up from the airport and take him to his hotel and, you know, things like that. Buy him a box, bring him a box of cigars and some wine and, you know, little things that, you know, at the time was, you know, the greatest thing in the world, being a 22-year-old kid meeting, you know, these people you admire on. So, you know, it was great. And it was one of those things where, again, you see a whole different side of filmmaking where, you know, they've got money and they've got these things and you're doing, you know, you're this little cog in this big machine. And, you know, it's kind of a scary thing because there's so many people, so many different elements that when you make your own film, you kind of want a smaller thing where everyone is, you know, on a first name basis and everyone's kind of, you know, it's just a smaller thing. Even if it is a bigger scale production, it's nice to have that kind of camaraderie, whereas there wasn't that kind of camaraderie in a bigger budget film like that. But at the same time, it was still interesting and fun and, you know, exciting to be even involved in the smallest way on those films, but also learning, you know, and kind of giving me that sense of when I started making my own films, my own productions of, you know, no matter the smallest, whether it's the production assistant or, you know, the craft service person or whatever, giving them the same respect that you would as the DP or the, you know, special effects people, because, you know, everyone is there and everyone has a thought or a suggestion that might be worthwhile, even if they are sweeping the floor or picking up cable or, you know, lugging lights around. If they say, hey, maybe you should do it that way, their idea might be right and it might be better than, you know, what I had going. And at the same time, I'll get the credit for it. So sure, I'll take the idea. And it gives everyone that kind of energy and that thing of, hey, we're all here making this together and we're trying to make the best thing possible. And if it comes out great, great. If it doesn't, at least we had fun doing it. Where that same camaraderie wasn't on those productions, I couldn't say, hey, Joe Chappelle, I think this shot you have of Michael Myers is stupid. You know, you should try this or that. I mean, they would have, you know, killed me. Yeah, but, right. You know, it's one of those things of having that kind of thing of, you know, able to talk to someone without, because everyone's, you know, just a person. It's Doug Bradley. He takes a shit just like everybody else. So it's, for me, it's kind of taking that wall of, you know, superiority, whether someone has accomplished this or accomplished that, they still have the same, you know, things you were. It's just a matter of if you have that comfort of being able to talk with them about, hey, you know, we're all working on this film together. I think you should try that or do this. And, you know, I've always been open to that. And I think I learned it from, you know, kind of being suffocated on those bigger production films of wanting to, you know, give everyone involved their own kind of, you know, hey, we're all in this together. Let's try to make the best thing possible. And your input and thoughts are welcome.
I think that's a very good outlook. And I feel like, yeah, having talked to quite a few indie directors, I think it depends kind of where you grew up in the film industry, your attitude towards that. Because I've talked to a lot of indie filmmakers who have a similar kind of collaborative eye view of film and filmmaking.
Sure. Well, I think it's also one of those things. I think I've met so many people, and, you know, especially, you know, smaller budget things where they think their script is so great, or, you know, the production's so great, everything is so great, and it's like they're reinventing the wheel. I kind of look at everything as it's shit, you know, and you everything's been done before and it's been done better than you're going to do it. So the idea for me, I go in with kind of the smallest, you know, inkling of ego and just trying to use what I got in the best way I can do it and not thinking that I'm better than Hitchcock or going to come up with something as good as Carpenter, or, you know, because that stuff is impossible. So it's just kind of trying to find my own way and my own voice and not having this attitude of, boy, isn't this film great? Boy, The Deep Ones is really a great film. Unfortunately, I think all my stuff is shit in a sense. And when it gets this praise and I kind of re-examine it, then I'm like, oh, maybe it's not so bad. And then when I step back and look at it again, I'm like, you know, for what we had and what it was, and, you know, because for me, it's always kind of this hard look at yourself or whatever it might be and what you could have done different and all those kind of things. And, you know, after a bit of time, you kind of accept it. But it's, again, one of those things when you first cut something together or you're on set and it felt good and it worked, you have this great just feeling for it. But never that idea, oh, it's a masterpiece or it's this, because it could always be better. And, you know, and it, depending on the circumstances or the different actor or these different things, the whole thing could, or a script in this script in someone else's hands, who knows what that would have been. So I've always kind of looked at it with this, you know, this pessimistic eye, I guess, of it could have been, you know, half empty or whatever it would be instead of it being half full. But that same kind of no ego at all going into a project or finishing a project. It's just kind of, and when good things happen for it, whether they be reviews or, you know, this interview here, I mean, you know, that's a great thing that, you know, you want to talk to me and there's people out there that want to listen to us. I mean, I think that's pretty amazing for a little film, and whether it's because of Lovecraft or it's because it got into this festival or because of whatever it is, I think, you know, you've got to take the little things that come to you as the trophy of, hey, look, we accomplished this and we accomplished that. And that's pretty damn good for what we had to work with. And, you know, not the idea of, oh, well, it should be, you know, number one at the box office and it should be this and it should be that. It's kind of take the little things and, you know, take solace in those accomplishments instead of, you know, letting them be diminished by what could have been or what should have been, or, you know, how great your in your mind this script was, or how great the film could have been. Because there's numerous actors, you know, in the film, I won't name the names, but they absolutely hate the movie. And it's one of those things where you feel a little bit bad at first, but it's like, well, you read the script, you did your performance, and now you're saying that this should be changed and that should be changed. And, you know, it's just like, instead of just embracing it, well, I like what I did or that did and what it's getting and be happy with that, instead of kind of letting it be a negative experience because of your impression of the picture, instead of the positivities of filming it and its release and people liking it or people hating it, but at least people are talking about it, and take it as that instead of kind of disowning it or whatever it might be.
Well, just before we, I was just going to, seems like a kind of good note to kind of end on. Before we head on out, I do want to ask, what are you working on next, or what have you got planned?
Well, I'm trying again, you know, if everything goes forward, I'll start writing the sequel, hopefully next week. I'll know. So I'll start writing that and putting that together. And if not, you know, I've got this Western called Horse that I've been trying to get made for years that I really just, you know, love. It's kind of a Bud Bedeker, Sergio Leone combination with a little Howard Hawks. And it's just a really neat passion project of mine that I've been trying to get made. So, you know, it's one of those things of, there's, you know, I've got no problem writing scripts and numerous ones that I could let go at any time if the thing were right. And there's, you know, companies looking at them with other directors in mind. And but this is the one, the Western is the one I really want to make. And hopefully something will fall together and get it made. But that's the beauty of a Western. It's pretty much timeless. So there's no rush to get it out if it's not with the right company.
Okay. Well, that sounds interesting. And it's been great chatting to you. It's been great to have you on the show, Chad. And please do come back any time you like.
Well, thank you, Scott. I mean, it was a great, you were great. So I mean, we've been talking forever, but it felt like we just, you know, started a few minutes ago. That in itself is a great compliment to you, and I hope your listeners enjoy it as much as I did talking with you.
That was my guest, Chad, there, who I'd like to thank once again for coming on the show. And as always, I'd like to thank you, listener, for tuning in to this latest edition of New Horror Express. Remember, if you like what you heard, Be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify. Sadly, that is all for this time, but be sure to tune in again next Monday when I'll be talking to another great guest from the world of indie horror. Until then, though, see ya!